We will now move on to the next order of business. General Beckett, officer in charge of the Imperial Fleet, is waiting most patiently to address us.
A floating view screen appeared almost immediately, as though it had just been waiting for its cue, and the head and shoulders of General Shaw Beckett scowled impartially at one and all. His large, square head was set upon a pair of massive shoulders, though most of his intimidating bulk remained out of sight. His uniform stretched tightly across his great frame, and pinned to it were medals beyond counting. His wide mouth was set and stern, his dark eyes unwavering. As always, he was smoking a large cigar, and paused occasionally to blow smoke at the camera.
About time you got round to me. Right. Pay attention, and take notes if you have to, because I'm damned if I'm going through this again. Ever since the fleet was blown apart during the rebellion by outlaw ships and those bloody Haydenman vessels, we've been struggling to operate a skeleton service. Most of the star cruisers are gone, D&D class, and we're having to rely on destroyers and revamped frigates to carry a workload they were never intended to handle. We're short of crew, too. There are plenty of volunteers, but it takes time to train real crewmen. Can't let just anyone loose on a starship. We're using the bigger ships to protect food routes to the hardest-hit planets. There are lots of hungry people out there, but so far we've managed to avoid large areas of actual famine. Pirates have been a problem, attacking the convoys to sustain their black markets. There's always someone ready to profit from other people's suffering. We kill them as fast as we can catch them, but there are always more. What ships we have left over are on patrol, mostly out on the rim, watching for the insect ships.
His face disappeared from the screen and was replaced by the familiar sight of an alien insect ship. It resembled a huge ball of sticky white webbing tangled together, tightly compacted. Weapons and force shields of unfamiliar design were there, unseen. One such ship had murdered every living soul in an isolated Imperial base, and then almost wiped out Golgotha's main cities before Captain Silence and his crew destroyed it. No one knew where the alien ship had come from, or what they wanted. The one certainty about the aliens was the ferocity of their attack and their murderous intentions. The image of the ship disappeared, and General Beckett spoke again.
Given the limited number of ships at my disposal, I cannot risk launching any kind of preemptive strike. All I can do is respond to alien attacks, as and when they happen, drive the ships off, and then try to clean up the mess they've left behind. So far, we've been lucky enough to avoid the major destruction and slaughter the first ship brought to Golgotha, but luck has a nasty habit of running out. The bottom line is, people are dying out here on the rim, and there's damn all I can do about it. I must have more ships.
We're building them as fast as we can, General. But there are difficulties. There won't be any more E-class ships until we can establish a new star drive factory to replace the one that was destroyed in the rebellion, and come up with something to replace the clones who previously performed the dangerous task of actually assembling the drive. And of course, even D-class ships are horrendously expensive, at a time when every expense has to be weighed and justified. As long as the alien ships don't pose an immediate threat to the main empire...
We'll sacrifice the people of the rim planets to avoid having to raise taxes on everyone else. Rulers come and rulers go, but nothing really changes. Look, the insects came to Golgotha once, and right now we don't have anything to stop them making a return visit. You can't keep relying on Captain Silence and his people to bring off a miracle at the last moment. He couldn't save Lionstone from the rebels. The insect aliens are as much a mystery now as they ever were. We still don't know where they come from. They just appear out of nowhere, make their attack, and then disappear again.
As long as we keep them from getting too annoyed with us, there's a real chance they will confine their attacks to the rim, and not return to plague us here. A bleak philosophy, I'll admit, but in these desperate times we have no choice but to think in terms of the greatest good for the greatest number. We are not abandoning the rim worlds. We authorize you to remain where you are, and give them all the protection you can. As soon as new ships are available, they will be sent to join you. But that's all I can offer. Now, unless you have anything else to bring up...
As it happens, I do. There's something happening out here. Disturbing reports have been coming in from all along the rim concerning the Dark Void, and from any ship that stays too long near the Eternal Night. There are reports of whispers, dreams, and uncertain contacts coming out of the darkness. Voices of the dead, crying warnings, visions of wonders and nightmares, fleeting contacts with things that come and go in a moment. Espers have had dreams of a door opening and closing, and something awful peering through. There have been too many reports from normally trustworthy sources for me just to dismiss them. I am forced to make the only logical conclusion. There's something alive in the dark void.
For a long moment, everyone was quiet. In the 900 and more years since Giles Deathstalker used the Dark Void device to put out 1,000 suns in a moment, killing the billions of people on the planets that orbited them, no one had really learned anything more about the vast area of utter night called the Dark Void, save that ships which went into it rarely returned. Gutman turned to Owen and Hazel.
So Deathstalker, you and Miss Dark were the last people to travel deep into the Dark Void in return. Perhaps you could shed a little light on this phenomenon?
This is all news to me. We never encountered anything like that. Just because my ancestor created the Dark Void device, it doesn't mean I'm any more of an expert than anyone else. If Giles kept any secrets about the Dark Void, he never passed them on to me. But I really don't see how anyone or anything could be alive in there. There's nothing left in the Dark Void to support life. No light, no heat, nothing to feed on. How could anything exist there?
Not life as we know it. But who knows what forces the original Deathstalker unleashed when he activated the device. We still have no idea what it was or how it did what it did. Who can say what nightmares might be lurking in the darkness, birthed in a moment of mass slaughter and the worst horror?
That's ridiculous.
Is it? When you went into the Dark Void, you came back with a revived Haydenman, an old monster we thought we were well rid of. There could be anything in that darkness. Anything at all.
Everyone was looking at Owen and Hazel, who said nothing. There were things they knew about the nature and origin of the Dark Void that no one else knew, but they had sworn long ago, for very good reasons, to keep those secrets to themselves. They were too dangerous to be entrusted to anyone else. Besides, there was no obvious link between what Owen and Hazel knew and the phenomenon Beckett had described, or so they hoped.
Speaking of the Haydenmen, we come to the last part of my report. I think we were all somewhat surprised when the revived Haydenmen joined the rebel forces to overthrow the Empress, and we were even more surprised when we discovered they were actually obeying orders and taking prisoners when the Empire forces surrendered, rather than just butchering them all as they had in the past. They were, after all, the official enemies of humanity, until the AIs of Shub replaced them by being even more nasty and dangerous. You assured us they had reformed Sir Deathstalker. You said we could work with him. We should have known better. We shouldn't have trusted cyborgs, the men machines in their golden ships, the butchers of Brahmin II. Well, Sir Deathstalker, your old allies have returned to Brahmin II, destroyed their defenses, and taken control of the planet and its population. They've renamed it New Haydon, and surrounded it with a blockade of their unbeatable ships. The few reports that got out before all communication was cut off said the Haydenmen had been experimenting on the prisoners they'd taken, turning them into new, improved Haydenmen. And that they declared the entire population of Brahmin II was next. We have no idea what's happening down there now. And since we don't have a hope in hell of getting past the Golden Fleet, we have no way of rescuing the people of Brahmin II. Unless, of course, the Deathstalker has some ideas. He is, after all, the man who loosed the Haydenmen on humanity again.
A growing rumble of anger moved through Parliament, from the MPs to those gathered watching on the floor of the House.
They were a necessary evil. We couldn't have defeated Lionstone's fleet without them. Ask General Beckett. I had hoped the augmented men had moved on beyond their old agendas. I knew one Haydenman who was as fine a man as any I ever met. But it seems I have been betrayed again by those in whom I placed my faith. Still, let's not exaggerate the dangers of the situation. They only hold one planet, and as yet they don't have enough forces to do anything but defend it.
Are you suggesting we abandon the people of Brahmin II to their fate? I don't think the Empire would stand for that.
Why not? Isn't that what you were proposing to do with the people of the Rim planets? Sacrificing the few in the name of the many? No, Gutman, I'm not suggesting we write off Brahmin II's population. If only because the Haydenmen might eventually create a whole new army out of them. Hazel and I will go to Brahmin II alone and see what we can do to rectify the situation. I am, after all, responsible.
Hold everything. When did I volunteer to go on this suicide run?
Well, you don't want to miss out on all the fun, do you?
Well, there is that. I just like to be asked, that's all.
Lyles gratefully accepts your proposal and wishes you all good fortune. You're going to need it. Is this acceptable to you, General Beckett?
Damn right. It's his mess. Let him clean it up. But just in case they fail, we'd better consider the practicalities of scorching the whole damn planet. And hope we get as many of the inhuman bastards as possible before they can escape. And yes, that would mean scorching the human population, too. Sometimes wars like that. Back it out.
Gutman smiled down at Owen, who braced himself. Something bad was coming his way. He could just feel it. Gutman leaned forward, his voice entirely reasonable.
But before you leave us, the Deathstalker, we feel there are a few questions we would like answered concerning the various war criminals this house has sent you after. We can't help noticing that you do tend to bring them in dead rather than alive.
For some reason, they don't seem to think they'll get a fair trial here on Golgotha. The fact that not one accused war criminal has been found innocent by these trials of yours has not escaped them. So, not unexpectedly, they want to fight to the death rather than be taken. Don't blame us for a situation you've created.
We prepare our cases very thoroughly. We find them guilty because they are guilty. Surely you don't think I'd allow my fellow ex-aristocrats to be falsely accused?
This from the man who killed his own father to get ahead. Pause for sustained hollow laughter.
Gutman shrugged.
Things were different then. I am another man now. Or don't you believe people can change, my dear ex-pirate and ex-clone-legger?
Hazel scowled but said nothing, for which Owen was very grateful. He would have had to try to defend her, which would undoubtedly have led to harsh words from both sides, and knowing Hazel, the possibility of open violence. Having made it this far without bloodshed, he would prefer to keep it that way.
The war trials exist to show the people of the Empire that justice is being served.
They exist because they're popular. People need scapegoats. What are you going to do when you run out of real villains, Gutman? Start investigating anyone who dares disagree with this new order of yours?
Only the guilty need fear the people's justice.
And you decide who's guilty.
Parliament decides.
And you speak for Parliament. How very convenient.
Let us move on. Next on the agenda is a proposal which I think will guarantee some lively debate. I'm sure I don't need to remind most of you that many seats will be contested shortly in the first free election since the fall of the Iron Throne. What you may not be aware of is that many ex-aristocrats have expressed their intention to stand for many of these seats.
No way in hell! I didn't fight a war to throw those bastards out of power just so they could sneak back in. The deal Randa made was clear. The families renounced political power in return for being allowed to survive as financial institutions. Let them get into Parliament, through bribes and intimidation as likely as not, and they'll just end up running things again.
You really must learn to curb your paranoia, Sir Deathstalker.
Everyone turned to look. Grace Schreck met their gaze with a mien of cool indifference, her nose stuck firmly in the air. Since Gregor's forced withdrawal from public scrutiny, his older sister Grace had taken over as head of the family, and to everyone's surprise, was making an excellent job of it. Toby and Evangeline had both been too busy, and were in addition, reluctant to take over as the Schreck, so the position had fallen to Grace pretty much by default. Her time in the limelight seemed to have agreed with her. Long, tall, and more than fashionably thin, with a pale swan-like neck, a pinched face, and a massive pile of white hair stacked on top of her head, in an old-fashioned and precarious-looking coiffure, Grace made a striking picture among the more colorful birds of prey that surrounded her. Ancient and austere, Grace hadn't been out in public regularly for years. She'd hated attending court, and only did so when bullied into it by Gregor. But she'd taken to the less formal and infinitely less dangerous Parliament with astonishing ease, and was now a spokesperson for many of the older families, who trusted her precisely because she'd been out of touch for so long, and therefore had no attachments to any particular clan or cause. She wore clothes so old-fashioned they were actually in vogue again, and possessed a quiet style and brittle wit that had won her the respect of many. The acceptable face of the ex-aristocrats, the hollow audiences adored her, and would listen to arguments from her they would have shouted down from any other aristo.
Everyone has a right to stand for Parliament. A democratic right. Isn't that one of the things you claimed to be fighting for, Sir Deathstalker? That everyone be treated equally? Ex-aristocrats have as much a right to be heard as anyone else. After all, you yourself were once a lord. Are you saying you should be banned too, your voice withdrawn? You are not the only member of a family to understand the concepts of redemption and atonement.
I could have taken power. I chose not to.
How very noble of you. But who is to say you might not change your mind in the future? I really cannot see what all the fuss is about. We are talking about free elections taking place under safeguards you yourself helped to set up, with people voting according to their own consciences. If some of them choose to place their trust in a member of a family to represent them in Parliament, that is their business and no one else's.
It's not as simple as that, and you know it.
Diana Virtue glared across the floor of the house at Grey Shrek, who smiled condescendingly back. Diana's scowl deepened, but she kept her temper under control.
The Espers will not place themselves again under the power of those who once treated them as property, who mistreated, abused, and murdered them at will.
The excesses of the past are deeply regretted. All the families understand that they have to prove their worth and place in the new order, and none of us are stupid enough to risk that place by resuming old and discredited practices. All of us have done things in the past that it pains us to remember, but we must learn to look to the future. The families have much to offer. Everyone here understands what you suffered, Esper Virtue, how you were left physically and mentally scarred. But we cannot allow one woman's obsessions to stand in the way of progress.
Diana clung grimly to her self-control. This wasn't the first time Grace had sought to undermine her arguments by referring to her past self, Jenny Psycho, whose mental stability had been somewhat changeable. She couldn't respond to the accusation directly. "All right, I was crazy then, but I'm better now," didn't exactly inspire confidence. So as always, she ignored the insult and bowled on regardless.
"The Espers will never bow down to Aristos again. We broke free of our chains through blood and suffering and the sacrifice of many. We will not be shackled again."
Pretty rhetoric, but essentially meaningless. This talk of masters and slaves is from the past. Let it stay buried there. The rest of us have moved on. And as I have pointed out in this house before, I dispute your claim to speak for all Espers. You distanced yourself from the official underground leadership when you began talking openly of your distrust of the Mater Mundi, and your following among the rank and file is not what it was. You speak only for yourself these days, Esper Virtue.
"Then let's talk about Blue Block."
Head snapped around to look at Finley Campbell. Finley didn't often speak out in Parliament, but when he did, everybody listened. Not least because he was always blunt and to the point, and to hell with whoever got upset. The cameras floating overhead rushed to zoom in on him. Finley smiled coldly across at Bibi Chojiro and her people.
"How can we trust the families when most of them are still under the influence of a once-secret organization, Blue Block? Who knows what plans they have and what secret ends they might still be pursuing? Their motives, like their background, remain largely unknown."
Bibi Chojiro stepped forward, her voice rising sweetly in the quiet.
"The fact that we are no longer secret should put an end to most of those fears. We have come out into the open, both to restrain and rebuild the families, to make them once again a positive force within the Empire. Yes, in the past, we were created to be the clan's personal assassins, deadly agents aimed at their enemies. But we have evolved beyond that. And you, of all people, have no right to criticize us. How much blood is on your hands, Sir Campbell? How many died under your blade?"
"Not enough, apparently."
"I think we've taken this argument as far as it can go for the moment. Let us move on, please. We have a hollow message from Her Holiness Mother Superior Beatrice Christiana. She is too busy overseeing relief work on Lacrimae Christi to speak to us in person, but she recorded this for us earlier."